This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Thank you very much, Nelson. It is a privilege to be here this afternoon. I always get the feeling, I get two feelings when I begin preparing for a talk like this. One is that I look around my office, realize how unorganized a lot of it is, and wonder why I agreed to a talk like this. The other is that when I get in front of people like you, I get this feeling that there's a lot that I don't know that you do. And so I'm going to share some of the things that I've learned over the few years that I've been in the office, and hopefully have some time for questions and sharing some tips at the end. If you have things that I haven't learned that you have, I'd be happy to hear from you. So I've recently found myself going somewhere while planning where I needed to be after I got to where I wasn't yet. That a quote isn't original with me, but frankly, that's how life feels sometimes. You know, I don't know if you feel like me, but sometimes that sort of describes my life. Trying to keep track of so many things, trying to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing next, and what's the most important thing. How can I optimize the things that I'm doing to hopefully give more time for the things that are maybe more important than some of the office work that I'm doing. Not to say that office work is not very important, of course. I believe that if you are to do well in the office, if you're to do well actually in any role, the first thing you need to know is why you do what you do. And so I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about that and maybe some ways to think about what you do. Every once in a while, there's this sign that shows up on my office door. No, it doesn't really, but I sometimes think it does, this little thing that says, you are this far behind. You know, how many hours, how many days, how many years? When I see signs like that, when I see the piles of paper in my office, I'm tempted to quicken my pace. I'm tempted not to spend as much time talking to people. Perhaps I'm tempted to do what's best illustrated through a news article that I saw just a few days ago. The headline reads, "Tax Auditor Dies at His Desk, Not Found for 2 Days." Believe it or not, this is an actual happening. He closed his door, was working in his office, had a heart attack or something, died at his desk. For 2 days, no one discovered it. I hope I would know if one of my colleagues or if one of the people that I work alongside would die at their desk. How soon would you find that out? I trust you have more interaction with the people that you work with than that. But it does illustrate the fact that, you know, sometimes we get so focused, so busy with what we're doing, the minutia in what we're doing in the office, that we forget why we're doing what we're doing. Reminded of a quote by Dorothy Sayers. She says, "Work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but a thing one lives to do. It is, or it should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God." Now, I know that most of you, if you're involved in ministry, are not doing what you're doing because of the money that's in it. But there are other temptations to use our work for maybe fame. Maybe it's the fame that comes through what we're doing. Maybe it's our influence, our level of influence, to try to increase our level of influence. Work is the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, the medium in which he offers himself to God. I'm also reminded of a quote by Kevin D. Young. He says, "The busyness that's bad is not the busyness of work, but the busyness that works hard at the wrong things. It's being busy trying to please people, busy trying to control others, busy trying to do things we haven't been called to do. We were made to cultivate the garden of God, to replenish the earth and subdue it. The pains and the thorns were curses, but not work itself. We were made to be busy." Or perhaps in the words of Jesus in Matthew 22, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." I'm convinced that good work done poorly does not glorify God. But on the other hand, I'm also convinced that poor work done well is not loving people. You know, as an illustration, the health and wealth gospel can be preached with all the flashy PowerPoints that the wonderful, the organization and the skills and all that. But if the work itself is not valid, it doesn't glorify God, and it doesn't it isn't loving our neighbor. And of course, a quote from Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Paul is giving an exposition on the resurrection in this chapter. He talks about he gives a defense of the resurrection. He talks about why all of what we do is valuable only because of the resurrection. In verse 17, "If Christ be not raised, your faith is vain, you're yet in your sins." Verse 22, "For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive." He sums up the entire chapter by saying, because of the resurrection, because of what God did for you, because of that, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Knowing why you serve is crucial to effective service in the business office and all of life. Wherever you find yourself, knowing why you serve and the motivation behind why you do what you do is the most important thing, I believe, in what you're doing. Second point I'd like to bring out this afternoon is that before you manage others, you should learn how to manage yourself. One of the things I try to do occasionally in the office is, actually lighten up and maybe send a comic like this to one of my coworkers. One of the things... And I would say learn to see the ironic in your work. A while back, we switched our telephone providers from Windstream to Armstrong Cable as part of the telephone service we were switching. As part of the way the billing cycle came out, Windstream cut us their final bill, came in the mail, and I opened it up. It was for 43 cents. Well, I thought, that's interesting. They just spent, the postage and the printing and the envelope and all that to send us a 43-cent bill. So I really didn't feel like cutting them a 43-cent check. So I decided to pay it online. So I went online, realized I need to set up a username and password. I need to actually, get access to our account and so on to pay this bill. Well, that really wasn't worth it. So I thought I'll call them. Well, I called them and got their automated service and, told them I want to pay the bill. And so they put me to the right place, put in the account number, and they said, please hold while you're connected to a representative. Well, okay. So a representative comes on the line. So I explained what I needed. He said, I could process the credit card payment for you over the phone. But if I do it as a representative, I would need to charge you a $5 processing fee. Instead, you can use our automated system and do it for free. I said, that'd be great. So he transferred me to the automated system. Ironically, it's the same system I had just talked to. When I got through to make the payment, it said, please hold while we connect you to a representative. So when a representative came on the line, different representative, I explained the process all over again. She said, well, yeah, it won't recognize your account because your account is closed. So I can process the payment for you. I was just waiting for her to say, but there'll be a $5 surcharge. She said, we'll waive the surcharge this time. So she processed the payment for me. I didn't ask her how much they pay in credit card processing fees, but just think about it. They mailed me the bill. I talked to two representatives. I used their website. I used their phone system. They paid the credit card processing fees. I had a good laugh at their expense once I got off the phone. Learn to see the ironic in your work. There are things like that actually strike some of us funny. Now, maybe that's evidence that I've been in the office too long. I don't know. One of the pieces of advice that I need to listen to more often than what I do is the phrase that was coined by Brian Tracy in a book by the title, and he says, eat that frog. It's the concept of swallow a frog first thing in the morning and nothing worse will happen to you the rest of the day. In other words, when I get to the office, it's that phone call I've been dreading. It's that email I don't want to write. It's that whatever it is, do the worst thing first. Nothing worse will happen to you the rest of the day. It's easy, much easier said than done. He says the ability to concentrate single-mindedly on your most important task, to do it well, and to finish it completely is the key to great success, achievement, respect, status, and happiness in life. Now, I won't promise you all the things that he promises you, but I do believe that is a very important concept and one that, like I said, I need to pay attention to more often. Another one is to compliment lavishly and thank constantly. A quote by Edgar Watson Howe, "The greatest humiliation in life is to work hard on something from which you expect great appreciation and then fail to get it." This type of appreciation, this type of lifestyle, living this type of appreciation for the work of others around me is what paves the way when confrontations or disagreements arise. However, it also reflects on me more than I sometimes want to admit. Do I truly value the contributions of others enough to notice when they're doing their job well? And I would encourage you to thank people by name, even the cashier at the grocery store. Quite frankly, they wear their name tag for a reason. And it's interesting. You get some interesting responses sometimes. Living a life of gratitude, living a life of appreciation for the things around you, I believe is a very, very important discipline, whether you're in the office, wherever you find yourself in life. In the words of Solomon, "The liberal soul shall be made fat, and he that watereth shall be watered also himself." Another way to manage yourself is to read and learn regularly, and this can be from a wide variety of ways. Books, magazines, email groups, part of a Google group with some other Anabaptist accountants, and it's a place to go for questions. It's a place to just see the things that other people are involved in and the types of questions that come up in their lives. Seminars are a great way. One of the best tips I have gleaned through the years when in relation to attending seminars is to try to pull one or two ideas and implement those ideas. Don't try to take the whole thing in. You won't be able to implement it all. I would also say that one of the most valuable pieces of seminars for me is meeting the speakers that speak there. I'm reminded of Frank Deegan. He's a tax attorney from New York, or New York, if you ask him, his heavy Bronx accent. He spoke at several conferences that I've been at, and went up and met him and introduced myself and so on. About a year later, I found myself with a very nuanced tax question that I had no idea where to go. It involved the way state versus federal taxes are done and so forth. I thought of him, so I sent him an email, and lo and behold, within a day, he responded back, said, "Oh yeah, check this tax court case and this tax court case." And a day later, he said, "You know, I've been thinking about this last night, and I really think this particular case would apply." This is information I had no idea where I would have gotten it. But attending a seminar, talking to the speaker, introducing myself, gave me that resource to go back to later and get the information that I really needed. And then, of course, conversations. How can you place yourself around the same table as an expert in the field that you have questions about? Are there ways you can engage people in informal conversations as you go about your work, or and wherever you find yourself? And then implement the new ideas. Kevin Miller, in his book Surviving Information Overload, says, "When I sign up for a seminar, I open my calendar and block a chunk of time on the day I will return. That's always a busy day, catching up on voicemail and emails from when I was gone, but I try to fence off 2 hours in which I can look over my starred items and send memos, hold conversations, make calls, change systems. If I don't immediately act on the seminar's key ideas, I usually lose the motivation and then the insight." Alfred North Whitehead wrote, "Ideas won't keep. Something must be done with them. When the idea is new, its custodians have fervor, live for it, and if need be, die for it." But while you are utilizing, implementing all these ways for learning, learn how to handle information overload. Quite frankly, we are deluged with information these days, and there's a much, much more that comes in than what we can ever implement, what we can ever utilize, what we can ever internalize. And so, a couple ideas. Touch a paper only once. I don't do well at this, but it's a great idea. It works well when I implement it effectively. Read your mail standing by the recycle bin. I guarantee it will cut down the time you spend on junk mail. Read your emails only once. Reply immediately. And if, like me, you're addicted to information, here are two additional quotes from Kevin Miller. I've learned that lots of information is a poor substitute for simply thinking. Insight matters more than information. Wisdom has always been in short supply, and wisdom builds from very basic principles, not generally from mountains of information. And another quote, ask yourself, does anyone else keep this information? Yes, much information must be stored, but does it all have to be stored by you? Maybe not. There's quite a number of ways that can be implemented. I think of things like IRS forms or publications, for instance. You don't actually have to have a print file in your copy. Print copy in your file. If you have high-speed internet access, you can easily download another copy. And those are regularly updated, so that's the easiest way to get the most recent copy. Bank statements could be another thing. You can pull them from your bank. What are the things that other people are storing, whether it's other people in your organization, whether it's online, that you can take advantage of their filing system, don't have to actually file it all yourself. A few additional ideas on managing yourself. Answer the phone with a smile on your face. Quite frankly, you can hear when someone on the other end is smiling. I don't know if you've experienced that or not, but I've tried to exercise this. Overcommit. It's a great way to see what you're really capable of doing. But at the same time, I would say, take care of yourself. You're your own best customer. Quite frankly, if you don't take care of yourself, probably no one else will. And I don't mean to get humanistic about it, and yet you have to know your limits, and you have to abide at least at some level within those limits. A quote by Parker Palmer, self-care is never a selfish act. It is simply good stewardship of the only gift I have, the gift I was put on earth to offer to others. And remember, in the end, it's who you are that makes a difference. This is in areas like competence. You have to know how to do the things you're called to do. It's things like trust, which is built over a long period of time, frankly. Some of the people that must trust you are your coworkers, board members, employees, your peers, so forth. Character. There are things like integrity and honesty that any skill you might have cannot take the place of those key components. Confidentiality. And development takes time. Quite frankly, I am nowhere near where I want to be in this area. And I want to learn better how to manage myself as I manage others. Next point I'd like to spend some time on is how to empower your workspace. One of the ways that I would suggest doing this is organizing your desktop. Pay attention to what you use and what you don't use. If you are sitting at your desk, look at the things around you. What are you using? What are you not using? If you're using them every day, put them within easy reach. For me, it's things like the phone, the stapler, the letter opener. They have to be within very easy reach of where I'm sitting. But if I don't use it very often, I'll put it a little further away. So, for instance, bank statements. I might use them once a week or less. Well, put them in a drawer, put them a little further away. If you use it less than several times a week, put it even further away, where you have to actually get up and go get it. It keeps your workspace free for what you need to do, namely your work. And do an occasional reevaluation of these items. Count your moves. One of my first office managers that I worked under said the best office workers are lazy office workers. Okay, take that by what he meant, not by what he said. But his point was, count your moves. Can you flip papers a certain way? Can you place things a certain way? If you're doing you have a packet of papers, you need to get one from five stacks. Place the stack in the order that you want to collect those papers. Put the stapler on the other end. Don't put the stapler, behind it or something. Pay attention to the way you lay out your workspace and your workflow. Count your moves. It does make a difference. Organize your computer desktop. add or delete programs from your desktop based on their use. Move or group the icons. You can perhaps in a certain section you have your accounting icons or your whatever types of icons, Word and Excel might be at a different place in your desktop. The desktop can also be a temporary location, emphasis on temporary, for documents to review later. I try to keep mine as clear as possible. Sometimes of the year it gets a little cluttered, and this is one of those times of the year in the middle of tax season. But this is a temporary location. Try to keep it just as uncluttered as possible so you can easily access what you need to access. Pin items to the start menu, pin items to the taskbar. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on how to do some of these things. I have printed these items in your handout, and Google can help you out with this. Coworker can help you out with how to do some of these things. But essentially it makes it very quick to open the program that you need rather than needing to dig for it, needing to go find it. And that's the point, is to make it just as efficient as possible. And especially in Windows 7 or above, the Windows key plus a number can launch a program from your quick launch menu down next to the start menu. So if you're very frequently, for me, email for instance, Windows plus the number 4 will launch my email because it's the fourth icon in the row down at the bottom of the screen. And it's a quick tip for computer use. Organize your physical files. And a lot of the suggestions that I give aren't right or wrong. It's just a matter of maybe being aware of them. And for some of us who have more OCD than others, it can drive us crazy when some of these things aren't in place. Do you file your invoices front to back or back to front? It can help you find an invoice if you know it's paid about the middle of the year. It should be about the middle of the file. Do you file your files right-handed or left-handed? So when you stick a piece of paper in the file, if you're right-handed, you typically grab the piece of paper, flip it, put it in the file. If you're left-handed, you grab it the other way, flip it, put it in the file. Again, probably isn't going to make a big difference, but when you're looking through a folder full of documents, some are this way, some are this way, and you're trying to figure out, looking for a document, for me, I like them filed a certain way. And it's right-handed because I happen to be right-handed. Do you file your invoices by alphabetically or by type of expense? Again, not a big deal, but just something to be aware of. There's varying ways you can do these things. Do you file something? Do you digitize it or do you toss it? Rule of thumb I'll often go by is, if it's printed anyway, drop it in a file. Now, if I know I'm not going to access it, of course I pitch it, but a lot of times I'll drop it in a file. It might come in handy. But more and more I'm going toward digitizing things, going toward paperless, and it has empowered the stuff that I do immensely. One of the ways it helps the most is it simply it allows you to access things remotely. So for myself, my tax business is based out of my home office. I also work at Faith Builders, and somehow tax clients don't know to call me only when I'm at home. They actually call me in the middle of the day at Faith Builders. I pull up my computer remotely and have all my documents because I've scanned them in. So pay attention to what you need there. But there again, scanning can be a waste of time if you'll never access the document again. So it's something where just keep in mind what's fitting for your particular situation. And then organize your computer files. Not going to go into detail there, but there's a lot that could be said in that regard as well. Next section, I want to talk just briefly about taming your email inbox. A few philosophical observations about email. One is to be aware of expectations. Emails and other forms of instant communication, like cell phones and so forth, have a certain expectation built with them. It's the expectation that you will reply within 5 minutes or 10 minutes at the most. Sometimes that's not possible. I don't respond to my emails within that amount of time typically. What's the expectation for email? I don't necessarily say that you need to always meet that expectation, but be aware that the sender might have certain expectations about how soon you will reply to them, for instance. And know the limitations of email. Someone once told me that emails will be interpreted in the harshest light possible. and that's often the case. Emails can only convey a certain amount of complex information before they just get overly cumbersome and are no longer effective. And so, know the limits and stay within the limits. And the more heated or sensitive a topic, the less valuable email becomes. Email always works better when you have a personal relationship with the recipient. I can fire off an email to my coworker, you know, two sentences, and they know exactly what I mean. When I fire off an email to someone that I don't know or someone that I don't know very well, it takes quite a few more sentences to explain it. Email works by far better when you have a relationship with someone outside of email or outside of the digital world. So, a few practical email tips. Use the to and the CC boxes appropriately. If you want a response from someone, put their name in the to box. If you don't care whether they respond or not, you really don't need them to respond, but this is for their information only, use the CC box. If you get an email, you see your email is in the CC box, you know that you can respond if you want. Mostly it's just for your information. And use the BCC box when you want to do what's called a blind carbon copy. The recipient won't see who else you're sending the email to. This one is an important one, especially if you're sending out mass email and newsletters. I don't know if you do any of that type of thing, but don't just put all their emails in the to box. Frankly, it looks very unprofessional, and it is also possibly a breach of privacy. I mean, it's giving everybody all the email addresses of your entire email list, which you don't want to do. Use reply and reply all appropriately. Reply, of course, goes only back to the person who sent it. Don't hit reply all if your response won't matter to the rest of the recipients of the email group. A lot of these tips, frankly, are to cut down the number of emails that people get. If everybody takes these tips seriously, I think we can actually help curb some of this email problems that we have, or that I have anyway. Attach items when you type attached. Okay, so maybe a few of you have sent sent emails that say, you know, attached is such and such and such, and got a response saying, attached? Really? Where'd it go? I try to practice this. So if I'm emailing someone and then I say attached is, I stop right there and go and attach it. That's my trigger to attach that document. Reread the emails before sending them, especially if they're sensitive in nature. That one goes without saying. Use folders and subfolders to store emails to be archived. And use mail rules to sort mail for you. So if you're getting newsletters and you want them to go into a certain folder, you can set up Outlook to automatically put them in that folder. Gmail Online will do that as well. You can also use mail rules to automatically forward certain types of emails to automatically, you know, if they're from a certain person, for instance, and you always want emails from that person, perhaps it's a newsletter, perhaps it's a whatever it might be, you want it forwarded to someone, you can set up rules to automatically do that for you. Cuts down your time on that. Email Outlook can also send auto replies to messages. So if you for instance, are out of the office, you can set up an auto reply. These methods are sometimes effective and sometimes are not. I once sent an email to one of my coworkers using delayed delivery. I was in a meeting with that person because I wanted this document sent to them after the meeting, but it wasn't going to make sense if you got it beforehand. So I told Outlook to do delayed delivery. My coworker was going to be leaving the office immediately after that meeting. He was going to be gone for several days. So he had set up an auto response. Any emails that come in, auto reply them out of the office. Well, while we were both in this meeting, our computers were busy doing what they're supposed to be doing. Mine sent him an email. His sent me an email. And, you know, that's the way emails sometimes go. Sure, it was effective eventually when we both got our emails, but it wasn't necessarily what we had intended when we set up the auto send and auto reply. Save time with electronic shortcuts. Memorize the most commonly used keyboard shortcuts, and I just mentioned some here. Control X to copy, Control X to cut, Control C to copy, etc. These are shortcuts that are basically universal in any Windows program, and can definitely cut down on your time. Alt-Tab is, I would say, the most important keyboard shortcut I have ever learned in Windows. Alt-Tab switches from one application to another that you have open. So, to demonstrate, if I hold down the Alt key and I press Tab, a little window pops up with all the... I'm still holding down Alt, but all the windows that I have open are here in the middle. If I release Alt, it goes to the program that was highlighted. Hit Alt-Tab. This is particularly useful if you're switching back and forth between two different pieces of software. Multiple monitors can cut down on the use of this, but frankly, I use Alt-Tab probably more than any other keyboard shortcut. Tremendous time saver. I already had mentioned Windows plus the number to launch a program from the taskbar. And program-specific shortcuts, there's a whole list of shortcuts in QuickBooks, for instance, that can dramatically decrease the time that you spend in that program. Another tip is to store shared documents where other people can access them. Maybe that's on a network, maybe that's on a maybe that's in Dropbox, maybe it's in SugarSync, other programs like that. If there's people that will need to access these files, can you put them somewhere they can access them without actually asking you for them? And then, of course, teach other people how to find them, or maybe send them links to folders and so forth. Google Forms, I don't know if you've ever used Google Forms or not, but I found that to be extremely useful in giving out surveys, for instance. You can set up a form using Google, send that form via email, the recipient clicks on a link, fills out the form, it will tabulate all the data that they sent, will tabulate it into a spreadsheet, and you can do whatever manipulation you need to do with that. It sure beats getting responses by email and keying them into a database. If you registered online for Reach, you have seen the power of this at work. We use Google Forms to do a lot of our registration processes, go straight into a database. We can manipulate it however we need to then, but it saves us from having to manually enter this information if somebody sends it by email. I use it for various things around the office if I need to get feedback on something, for instance. Excel tips. Just a few things that I'll say that you should learn how to do. Charts and pivot tables are the two things that come to mind the most. I'm not going to go into detail with this. This is an entire day or more of learning. I've only scratched the surface learning myself what all is involved in Excel. And then automatic financial report exports. A lot of financial software do automatic reporting. You can save reports, and perhaps it exports to Excel automatically. There's just a variety of things that you can do typically with financial software. In conclusion, I'll bring us back to this verse, because for me, I think all these tips, all these strategies, all these things that can hopefully help you cut down the amount of time you spend on paperwork, the amount of time you spend on monotony, hopefully can increase the joy that you feel in the office as you stay on top of things. It's all, quite frankly, it doesn't mean anything unless the time you save, unless the things you're doing have a value outside of the work itself. And so in the words of Paul, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. At this point, I'm going to open it up. Are there questions that you have? Are there maybe some tips that you've figured out over the years that would be good for people to know about? What do you have to say? What have you learned?
I might add that I think Windows to the F4 is maybe a little far of a reach. There's also, if you create a desktop shortcut and you can right-click on it, you can then go to Properties and add a Control Alt and any other key you want to that. And so all my folders that I'm going in many times a day, I usually do like Control Alt and the period or the comma, so I can just quickly with one snap of my wrist, boom, I can be there.
Hmm. Very, very important. Yes. Tip there.
I don't have anything on my desktop. All my programs, all my folders are keyboard shortcuts where I just hit Control Alt and another button.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, again, what he mentioned, if you right click on an icon, you can do establish a Windows shortcut and can tell Windows what keyboard shortcut to use to access that program or folder or so forth. Excellent. Thank you. The concept of hard time and soft time, it is often helpful to think of your time in relation to the hard time, which might be meetings, it might be whatever the things are that it can't change. I mean, like that time is set, and so for the next hour, I have dedicated my time to such and such a thing. Soft time being the time in between them. And in good time management, you learn to structure, for me, it's structuring meetings around hard time. So I can be much more productive if, let's say, I'm coming out of a meeting, I schedule another meeting immediately on the tail of that, rather than saying, well, you know, I give myself an hour of soft time and then do another meeting in the middle of my soft time. That soft time is the time that you have to be very productive in your office work, the time when, okay, you don't have to be doing that, but you have to do it sometime. And if you can get your hard time and your soft time in blocks, much as possible is often very helpful. To managing time, so forth.
You need to have adequate time in meetings, but if you schedule meetings back to back, you're a lot more focused on getting the meeting done and getting on to the next one, and having, like you're calling soft time, having mm-hmm. larger proportions mm-hmm. of that at another time.
Right.
But having those meetings back to back makes for shorter, more focused meetings.
Excellent point. Yeah. If we have a deadline, we actually often meet them, or at least try harder than if we don't have as much of a deadline. Excellent point. Evidently, my computer hopes the presentation is about done. It's saying the power is about running out. I would mention the resource page on your handout. Take a look at that. There's a number of books, a number of articles, and resources that I would mention on there that might be helpful to you, hopefully will be helpful to you in your work. When I think about the experiences I've had with managing the business office, with trying to do it efficiently, with trying to do it effectively, trying to make space for other things in the office, one of the things that I think about is my experience with a man by the name of Lynn Job. Lynn Job is an insurance salesman, and he comes around to our office frequently. He needs to. I mean, in the course of business, he is doing his work, and so he drops by. However, for Lynn, dropping by my office, frankly, has become much more about enjoying my presence, I believe, than about selling his insurance. In fact, it seems like sometimes he tries to come up with reasons why he needs to drop by, and anyway, sit in my office for an hour. That can get really frustrating when you're in the middle of a busy day to have this person drop by and just sit there and talk when he doesn't really need anything. Obviously, he doesn't really have anything to do. He's an older gentleman who probably wouldn't need to do insurance, but insurance gives him a purpose in life, and so he continues to sell insurance. One day as he was sitting in my office, though, I made the connection between sitting there and talking with him and why I do what I do. And it was through his comment that I love coming here. He said, the environment is so peaceful. I thought, that's interesting. Suddenly, the time that I spent listening to him took on all new meaning. This wasn't about what do I need to do for him to, you know, sort of get him out the door as quick as possible so I can get on to the next thing. It actually was about, it's about my mission. It's about my calling in life. It's about who am I and why am I doing what I'm doing. It's about far more than just organizing the office. And so I'm going to leave you with that. keep in mind that the interruptions, even the salespeople, quite frankly, telemarketers need to interaction with Christians too. I get a little irritated with them sometimes, but that presence can come through on the phone, even with telemarketers. And I encourage you to continue learning tips and tricks and strategies to be more efficient in what you do. But pay attention to the people that you interact with. Don't allow your efficiency to get in the way of caring well for the people that might drop by your office every day. Thank you very much for your attention. Hope you have a good afternoon.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.